WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest is Robert Townsend, who's written a revised edition of his 1970 bestseller, Up the Organization. Further up the organization, How to Stop Management from Stifling People and Strangling Productivity, has just been published by Knopf. Townsend writes that in the average company, the folks in the mailroom, the president, the vice presidents, and the steno pool have three things in common. They're docile, they're bored, and they're dull. They're trapped in pigeonholes of organization charts, and they've been made slaves to rules of corporate hierarchies that run mindlessly on and on because nobody can change them. Townsend describes his solution as nonviolent guerrilla warfare. He suggests we start dismantling organizations where we're serving them and leave alone the parts where the organization is serving us. Townsend has had a successful corporate career. In the early 60s, he was the head of Avis when the We Try Harder campaign was launched and Avis turned into a successful company. He's also been an executive at 20th Century Fox, American Express, and Dun & Bradstreet. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air, Robert Townsend.
Thank you, ma'am.
Let's talk about when you took over Avis. The company was, I believe, not doing very well. What a lot of people would do when they walked into a new company that they wanted to turn around was fire everybody that they could and replace them with their own people. Did you consider doing that, and did you do that?
No, of course not. As a matter of fact, I was told that I had to fire everybody by my predecessor, but I knew that was nonsense. From my experience in any company's people are underused because they don't see anything in it for them to work hard. So I was in New York and the headquarters was in Boston. So I flew up to Boston, listened to all this stuff about you got to get rid of everybody. Walked in, he said, "Do you want me to introduce you?" And I said, "Please don't." And walked into the headquarters and asked to meet everybody that reported to the chief executive, and they came in to the office, and I said, "Look, my name is Townsend, and I'm your new chief executive officer, and I don't know doodly squat about the rent-a-car business, but I assume you people do because you've been here 13 years, and even though you've never made any money in 13 years, it seems to me that there's room for another company besides Hertz. So I've got a suggestion. Why don't we figure out how to make money in the rent-a-car business and have a lot of fun and get rich?" Whereupon smiles broke out on everybody's face, and they all began to think about what we need to do to build a rent-a-car business. Well, the first thing we had to do was raise some money, so we got a bank loan agreement. Second thing we had to do was buy new cars because we had old cars. And the rental agents were hiding when planes came in rather than rent the customers those old cars. Third thing, we had to get an advertising campaign that would let people know we were in business too. And having done that, that's about all. At that point, we decided to go out and bring our message to the troops. So 10 of us visited 13 cities in 10 days. And 10 of us did 300 cities in 10 days. I did 30. And what my message was, I put the ads up on the walls of the garage, and then we'd have the meeting at the turn of a shift, so we'd get both shifts of rental agents and maintenance agents, and I'd say to them, "Look, we've done everything we can. We've got you a new advertising program. We've got new cars, and now it's up to you. You are the important people in this business. The reason you're the lowest paid people in the rent-a-car business is because we're the lousiest company and have been. We've never made a profit. We want to be the most profitable company in the rent-a-car business, which to put it in perspective means we'll keep 6 cents out of every dollar. That would make us the highest profit margin company. Out of that 6 cents, we'll put a penny back in your pay envelope, which can be substantial. And with the rest of it, we'll do research and development, like devise a computer system that will write the rental agreements and handle our reservations without mistakes. But in order for us to get there, we need more than 10% of the market. We need about 30. And that's up to you people. You're either going to stand up and smile when a plane comes in, and you maintenance agents are going to keep the cars clean and the ashtrays empty and the cars parked in the right slots so when the poor tired slob gets off the plane and tries to find his car, it's parked in the right place, or you're not. And if you're not, why don't you quit and go to work for Hertz and make room for somebody who will? Well, you know, these people, every city I went to, every one of the 30 cities, they said, you know, this is the first time the president of Avis has ever been in our city. And this is the first time I've ever seen the president of Avis. And just to go out there and tell them they were important. And I wasn't conning them or manipulating them. They were important. If they didn't do their job, the success story of Avis would never have been a success story. So they did it, not me. And all I did was do the uncomfortable thing of traveling around for 10 days and talking in drafty garages to people. And it worked like a charm. But the message in that is that it's the poor, underpaid, underthanked people on the firing line that are important. And that's at the heart of business today. They're neglected.
Did their salaries go up considerably as Avis became more successful?
Yeah, not salaries. It was wages. These people were not, by the way, kids who just fell off the turnip truck. These were Teamsters, members of the Teamsters Union, and a lot of them were cynical and anti-management. And I found them really no different than anybody else. Once they heard the message and looked me in my bloodshot eyes, they recognized that I wasn't shucking them, that, what I said made sense, transparent, good sense, and there was something in it for them. And they cooperated, and they were just great.
How did the We Try Harder campaign get started?
Oh, well, I went around and interviewed a lot of advertising agencies, and our problem was we were so small. We didn't have enough money. And finally, my question was, how do we get five times the impact that our competition gets? And Bill Bernbach of Doyle Dane Bernbach said, easy, easy. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you just give us 90 days to study your company. And then you run every ad just as we give it to you and run it where we tell you to run it. And don't change it. Don't edit it. Don't change the picture. Don't change the copy. And we'll get you five times the impact, because what will happen when I tell everybody at our next staff meeting, I tell all our art directors and copy chiefs that in the Avis campaign, whatever we here at Doyle Dane approve will get run. When I tell them that, they'll all be moonlighting on your account. So you'll have all our best people working for nothing for you. And we'll come up with something. Anyway, after 90 days, I agreed to that. And after 90 days, he came out to our headquarters. And he said, Bob, I'm just so desolate. But he said, we've come up with a loser. He said, we've studied your company. The only things we've learned are that you're the second largest and that your people seem to be trying harder. But we can't make a campaign out of that. And he said, the ads that I'm going to show you, I'm really ashamed of. They say, Avis is only number two, so we try harder. And he said, I'm ashamed of the ads. And furthermore, he said, my own market research department tells me they're dynamite on the wrong side and they'll put you out of business if we run them. But they're all we got. And I said, well, we agreed to run whatever you recommended. Do you recommend? He said, I recommend them. So we ran them, and they attracted a lot of attention. And since our people had already seen them in the garage walls when we made our trip, they knew what the customer was talking about when he came up. When he'd come up and say, is this the company with the clean ashtrays? The person would at least know what they were talking about. And it worked. That's how it started.
So that really took off. Did you develop a lot of your management philosophy while you were at Avis?
Oh, no. No. I worked for a terrible company called American Express, which did everything in a bass-ackwards, anti-people fashion. It was a magnificent learning environment. It was marvelous. I mean, they hired from the bottom of the barrel. The chief executive was an ex-accountant who was only comfortable with numbers, you know, hated people. And to protect himself, like all the other managements, bad managements like General Motors and Ford, you know, they developed powerful staff organizations to get between them and the people. In General Motors, it's industrial relations, which is the outfit that they've built within their own company, whose main mission in life is to keep management and labor mad at each other. That's a good thing to spend money on, as anybody can realize. Well, personnel department at American Express was designed to make sure that there's no way you could get a raise other than the normal tip that they gave you at the end of the year to keep you just behind the increase in the cost of living. And the biggest goof-off in the company and the boss's nephew got the same tip as the guy who was really, or the girl who was a real champion, out working 16 hours a day, coming up with great ideas and fighting him through the organization, get exactly the same raise, all of them. That was the personnel department, a buffer zone between the chief executive and his people. So that was where I learned that almost everything big companies do is wrong.
How would you describe your approach to management?
Well, today it's called participative management. And the reason I was moved to bring this book out and to write what I've written is because it's really happening today, and it's happening in some big companies, Hewlett-Packard, Cummins Engine, Minneapolis Honeywell, Minnesota Mining Manufacturing, Procter & Gamble, Motorola. A lot of companies are using participative management, which basically is asking the people who do the work how to do the work, which is a novel concept, which has never occurred to anybody in the automobile business. And it's so encouraging to go back and forth across the company, a country. Let me give you an example of a participative company, People Express. Now, this is one that's started up and done, as far as I'm concerned, they've done everything right. They advertise when they're going to open up in a city. It's an airline. They advertise, would you like to be a manager? Starting salary, $19,000 a year, profit participation. Come to our hiring meeting and apply for a job. So people come. They are interviewed. They tell them in the ad that what they're looking for is somebody with a little college. Some college is the way they describe it. Energy and flexibility, willing to do whatever needs to be done to help the company get to its goals. So they interview people, pick the ones that look the best for their purposes, and then they give them 5 weeks of training before they get a job. Now, they pay them during the 5 weeks, but they let them know that you're just trying out for a job, and you either make it or you don't. Okay, let's say you do. You're a manager. That's your title, the day you get hired. If you don't have anybody reporting to you, the idea is you manage yourself. The president of the company is called manager director. You have two profit sharing plans from day one. You have 100% medical, dental, non-contributory from day one. You must own stock in the company. So if you have no money, the company makes you an interest-free loan so you can buy stock. And then you can buy more as time goes along if you choose to out of your profit sharing. Now, what happens is when a plane is about to leave from Newark for London, if the problem at the moment is schlepping baggage, they just open the door of the accounting office and say, baggage time, and all the accountants drop their computers and come out and schlep baggage onto the airplane. If the crunch is taking reservations, the accountants do that. Everybody does that. If it's selling tickets over the counter, if it's pouring drinks on the airplane, everybody does everything. Well, the result is the prices are much lower than the other airlines. Profits are going great guns. And they've got a people. They've got a participative organization. And it's working like a charm.
Do you think that it's easy for a large company that's already entrenched in non-participative participative style.
That brings up a point.
To
if any
around.
Of you people can change, can come up with a better term than participative
Call
management,
down, yes.
please let me know. It's a terrible term. Before you, let me tell you one story. The term before was worse. It was called organization development, and it immediately got shortened to OD. And everybody in academia called it OD, which is a great name. And no wonder it died.
Do you think it's easy for a corporation to change?
Of course not. It's terribly hard. It's terribly hard. If I were 15 years younger and somebody said to me, you have to, you are sentenced to change General Motors, how long do you need? I would say I need 15 years as chief executive officer, and it's possible. Now, I think you can change smaller companies and less entrenched companies in shorter periods of time. I mean, you can do it in as little, a smaller length of time as a year or two.
My guest is Robert Townsend, who has revised his 1917 bestseller, Up the Organization. His new book is Further Up the Organization. There are a lot of common practices that you recommend against. I'd like to go through some of those and find out why you oppose them. It's common for corporations now to hire outside consultants to come in and find out how the company can operate more productively or how to improve management-employee relations. You think it's a bad idea to bring in an outside consultant to come in and analyze the corporation and tell you that. Why?
Well, let me give you one exception. If you have a computer installation, a microprocessor installation coming, rather than build a whole data processing department, it makes more sense to bring in some consultant who really knows a specific kind of computer and is trying to prove a point by proving that he can install a system that costs 1/20th of what the digital equipment or the IBM equipment costs that will give more service. If you can find a guy with a real light in his eye, bring him in, let him install it, make it a condition that he stay with your organization until everybody agrees that it's working and knows how it works. That can be good. But the general type of consultant that you're talking about comes about because let's say a division is failing. Well, there are two things that a chief executive officer can say to his board of directors or his stockholders if it's privately owned after 9 months of a division failing to meet its targets. He can say the right thing, which is, fellas, we're not going to have the next four board meetings because I'm going to be too busy. I'm moving into that division until I find out what the problem is and help them correct it. That's the right thing, but he never says that. What he says is, I'm hiring McKinsey and Company. And the board goes back to sleep, and of course McKinsey and Company does just what he should be doing, except they take a lot longer, they put a lot more people in there, and they cost a lot more money, and they insult everybody that's in there because everybody has to stop and explain who they are and what they're doing. Whereas if the chief executive moves in there and takes the guy who's running the division and who has failed to meet his budget, and you don't have to hang him upside down outside your building as a living example of a failure, what you do is you send him to the Caribbean. And you say, look, you're a terrific piece of woman power or man power or whatever, and we love you. It's just that you're not doing it right here in this particular slot. So go down there and don't feel insecure, and you're not going to be fired. When you come back, we're going to have a long talk about what you want to do and what you can do well. But meanwhile, the buck has come to me, and I'm sitting at your desk and to see if I can find out another way to go that will help this division meet its targets and its goals and help turn its people's light bulbs on.
Have you actually done that?
Sure, sure. It works. It's amazing how fast it works.
Okay, something else that you recommend against: having an assistant to the vice president, an assistant to the manager. Well, describe what that position is and why you don't think it's a good idea.
Well, an assistant is a deputy. It's someone who can make a decision in her boss's absence. Okay? An assistant, too, is a problem and a paper collector who can't make a decision, who can't give an answer in the boss's absence. All she can do is stall, ask questions, ask for memos, and improvise. It's a terrible place to put anybody. And there's some very bright people in that impossible situation. I had lunch the other day at USC School of Management out in California, and one of the professors, senior guy, came in, and he had administrative duties as well as courses in management to teach, and he was outraged. He said, "I've got an assistant too, and according to your book, I should be fined $100 a day until I get rid of the position." He said, "How dare you say that? My assistant too is a perfectly wonderful person. And what do you mean by that?" And I said, "Well, let me put it this way. When you go away, can she make decisions?" And he said, "No, of course not." And I said, "You realize that there are young Turks and there are champions and there are people in the organization who want to get things done right now, because right now is the time to do them, and they've got all the things, and they just need your permission. And you're bone fishing in the Caribbean, and your assistant, too, can't make the decision. If you didn't have an assistant, too, somebody'd have to get you on the wireless in Turks and Caicos Island to make the decision. And they do that. But since you've got an assistant, too, they go to her, and she says, 'Write me a long memo, and when he gets back, I'll have him read it.' What do you think these young Turks think of you? When you get back, you have lost face with the very people whose admiration and respect you need if you're going to fulfill your job. Frankly, to them, you're a schmuck."
Well, you even got rid of your secretary, didn't you, when you were, at Avis?
I did. But what I did there was... Because I noticed that we had a whole row of secretaries that seemed to me to be underworked, and executive secretaries develop a nasty habit, which is they don't want to work for anybody else. And if one of the executives would be in a real crisis, you know, they might reluctantly work for him or for her for a time, but it wasn't happy. And it didn't seem to work right. And since we were all out of our offices so much and out on the road, it didn't seem to me to make much sense. And so we formed an outfit called Staff Services. And what we really did is take those executive secretaries who agreed with what we were doing and put them in a palatial office and ask them to take care of phone calls, dictation, and whatever else of the 10 of us, or 16 of us, I think it turned out to be, who didn't have a secretary. Now, you can't explain to an outsider that you don't, if you're the chief executive officer of a company, that you don't have a secretary. It's too time-consuming for the organization. So all 10 of these women pretended to be who's ever secretary. The phone call came in. You know, the operator would plug in a call, Mr. Townsend's office, Mr. Murphy's office, whoever, you know, and she'd just pretend to be that person's secretary and do whatever it took. Now, these were very bright people, and to a woman, they all said to me, the day went a lot faster than sitting around trying to avoid taking on jobs for some other boss.
Let's go back to the assistant, too, for a minute.
Yeah.
Part of the reason for having an assistant, too, is so that some of the responsibilities of the position can be delegated. Some of the letters can be written by somebody else. Meetings can be scheduled by somebody else and so forth. And I think so many jobs end up accumulating many more responsibilities than one person could feasibly carry out themselves. If you get rid of the assistant, too, position, then you're back with one person who has more responsibilities than they could possibly do well in a day.
Yeah.
What's the alternative?
The alternative is to create a whole job that reports to your boss. And let's say president of the customer services department, and take some person from within the organization who needs more responsibility and needs more challenge and say, Jennifer, how would you like to be president of the customer service company that isn't a real company, but it's a nice title and the kind of title you should have if you're talking to irate customers? And you no longer report to me. You report to my boss, who's underworked. And you just take all this correspondence and handle it. And my suggestion to you as you take it over, if you agree, sounds like Mission Impossible, is to work yourself out of a job. See if you can figure out a way so that we don't get any more grievances or complaints or anything. Your job is to see how small, not how big you can make the correspondence, but how small you can make it, at which point I'm sure you'll be promoted again.
Do you think that it's true that the higher up you get in the hierarchy, the less work people have to do?
Yeah, absolutely. The less important work they have to do. It's a scandal. It's a scandal, and it's progressive. You take a president, new chief executive of a big company. He finally makes the grade, and he and his wife celebrate, you know, because she's been waiting so long for him to get the big slot. And she's been bugging him so long. But at any rate, he finally gets in that corner office. He's got three secretaries. He's got a private dining room. He's got a private elevator. He's got a private limousine. Let's say he's head of General Motors. He's got 90 speeches to make a year on why they're in South Africa. He's got to go to Aspen and meet with other chief executives and moan about how few good people they got in the organization. He goes down in his elevator. He gets into his Cadillac limousine, and he drives back to Grosse Pointe, which is aptly named. And he says, boy, this is a great car. Of course, 24 mechanics have been working on it all day long while it's been in the company garage. And all he sees are General Motors cars and Ford cars and Chrysler. He says, what's all this nonsense about Japanese cars? Well, of course, everybody in Detroit has to buy a General Motors or a Ford or a Chrysler car. It's not legal to buy a Japanese car, so they never see any of those things. After 4 months in that office, hearing only things that have been pre-digested and sugar-coated for his delectation, and meeting only with other chief executives and people within his own company that are very high up and know exactly what he wants to hear and tell him that, and after all his outside engagements and his golf clubs and his luncheon clubs and his speaking engagements and all of this thing, he doesn't know what the hell the company's doing. He's totally out of touch. He no longer sees the people who helped him get the job in the first place. And yet, think of it. He's paid $1 million a year, big stock options, all of this kind of stuff. And he says that to himself in his limousine going home every night. He says, my God, I paid $1 million and I didn't do anything today. And he gets more insecure, more unwilling to meet face-to-face with people in his own company, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. The result is you get industrial relations departments, you get personnel departments, you get purchasing departments, and you eventually make so many bad decisions involving people that you wind up with the United Auto Workers. And the United Auto Workers are so good at their job of getting wages and benefits up and getting job descriptions so narrow that if you drop a wrench, you have to get a wrench picker to come pick it up. If anybody but a wrench picker picks up that wrench, you get a grievance because it's a violation of union regulations. And all their work procedures are designed to prevent or postpone work. And if you want to change a crane, a machine on a crane, you have to get four gangs there to get all the proper job classifications there, and then you have to get a leader for the gang to do it. It's ridiculous. But the United Auto Workers comes out of bad management that's walled off and insulated from its people.
Well, before we tackle the question of labor unions, how would you stay in touch with what's happening inside a corporation if when you were CEO?
There's only one way. When you get the job, somebody has to say to you, and maybe it's only you, somebody has to say to you, you are not being promoted to this job so that you can retire on the payroll and go to Aspen and the Bohemian Club and things like that with your other chief executive, fellow chief executive. You're being paid here to get in touch with the company and find out where our problems and opportunities are. And we expect you to take off your coat, roll up your sleeves, and get on the road and spend at least 50% of your time on the road finding out what the hell is going wrong and what the hell can we do about it. And then coming back and getting the necessary people together into a temporary ad hoc project gang and concentrating on it until you get the problem solved. That's talking big companies. But otherwise, in smaller companies, starting participative management, which just means, well, read the book. It's a 3-hour user-friendly textbook on participative management.
I guess it's Robert Townsend, and the book in question is Further Up the Organization, which is his revised sequel to the 1970 book Up the Organization. Let's get back to labor unions. You've just said that labor unions are a product of bad management. Well, labor unions predate a lot of the discussion, the kind of discussion that we're having now, and I think grew up out of terrible working injustices.
Absolutely awful.
What do you think about unions today in major corporations? You see them as being basically an obstacle to good management-labor relations.
Yeah, they're a handicap, but it's not insurmountable. There are companies like Robinson Nugent in New Albany, Indianapolis, for instance, that just had a dreadful relationship with the UAW, a 7-month strike. But the Japanese backed them up against the wall. They make electronic components for automobiles and other industries. The Japanese backed them against the wall, and the union and the management came to the startling conclusion that there weren't two sides, and one was on one, labor was on one, and management was on the other. There was only one side, and they both better get on it immediately. And they did, and they now have a participative company with a union blessing. And all the grievances have gone, all the work procedures have gone, all the nonsense is gone, and they're using participative management, which, as we said at the beginning, just means getting the people who do the work to tell you how to do it. And it's done the way you started in a company. As you ask for volunteers who want to talk about how toaster ovens are assembled, and you legitimize it by making their meetings on company time, paid company time. And a lot of people won't volunteer and don't want to get involved and at the beginning. But if you can get one group together who sit down and will say, go over the whole process of assembling toaster ovens that they've been using for 10 years since some consultant from McKinsey and Company set up the assembly line, and they say, well, we're doing everything backwards. You know, if you sat here and did a little more of that and I sat here and did a little less of that and we moved it around here, we could put together 25% more toaster ovens with no more work. And so supervisor says, try it, because he has the power to do that. And then you have a steering committee if they get into things that cost money that will give them action right away. And the steering committee has members, all levels of management on it, and meets frequently and gives fast answers. And then the real key is if they come up with a solution to do it better, and as soon as you can measure it, and I mean next week, you hit everybody down there in the pay envelope with a bonus, some kind of a financial reward. Now what you've done is you've gotten everybody's attention. It's not going to cost jobs. It's going to create more pay because they should share. There should be gain sharing as the productivity increases. And now what happens, all of a sudden, instead of having a few volunteers, you've got a lot more volunteers who want to sit down, and pretty soon you've got what you set out to get, which is people at their place of work solving problems.
Do you think that participative management eliminates the need for labor unions?
Sure. I mean, I don't see people express ever having a labor union. But if you've got a labor union, it's not going to get rid of it. It's going to make it much less of a problem and eventually no problem at all. But there's no reason to think that it's something that will get rid of your union. You've got it. It's a handicap. What you have to do is learn to work with it.
What percentage of profits do you think should be channeled back to employees? And if it's a bad year, should the employees have a decrease in pay as they receive an increase in pay in a good year?
Well, I believe in gain sharing. If you have a bad year, there won't be any gain, and therefore there won't be anything to share. If you have profit sharing, if there are no profits, you won't have anything to share. But that puts everybody in the same boat, and it means that management and labor are both trying to figure out ways to increase the profits of the company so that paychecks can be higher. I think everybody has to figure out their own formula. This is what's going on in the country. I think there are 6,000 companies ranging from small, like People Express, to huge, like Hewlett-Packard, that are using their own tailor-made variation of participative management and their own reward system. I told you that People Express had two profit-sharing systems. In companies like Hewlett-Packard, for example, where participative management has been going on for a long time and where it's a high-tech business, the actual profit sharing is not all that important. Fair pay is important, but a lot of the rewards in a good company are just being part of the best company, working there and knowing that you get recognition for what you do. I'm saying that profit sharing is absolutely essential when you change from a bad authoritarian company to a participative company, because otherwise nobody will believe you. If they don't taste it in the pay envelope, they'll think you're just conning them again.
One of the reasons for labor unions is collective bargaining, so that if there's a grievance, you're not one person speaking out for yourself against a really large corporation. Do you see any equivalent in a participative management organization without a labor union?
I don't think I don't think there'll be any problem, because in a good company, you have a leader, not a corporate politician. You have a leader, not an administrator. He's not an accountant. He's not a lawyer. He's not a Harvard Business School graduate, chances are. And a leader, by definition, is somebody who cares about his people. And I know it was always my effort to see how much we could afford to pay our people. And, you know, I lusted for the day when everybody would be overpaid because it makes life so much easier. I don't think we never got rid of the Teamsters. We never tried to. I just regarded them as a slight handicap, and it was slight because I talked directly to the people. The union delegate was always there. But I just told them what I thought and went on and did what I could.
My guest is Robert Townsend, author of the new book Further Up the Organization, which is his revised edition of his 1970 bestseller. Do you think that there are many companies that are run by what you might call enlightened management, where the good of the employees is really taken seriously?
Oh, absolutely. It's happening. As I say, it's happening all over the country today. And the reason for it is, I think, we owe a great vote of thanks to Japan, because Japanese, you know, the difference is not the worker. It's not that the Japanese worker is a lot better than the American worker. Actually, I think the reverse is true. I'd rather have an American workforce any day. It's that Japanese management is better at getting creating an environment in which people will voluntarily bring their brains and enthusiasm to work. And American management has been terrible at that, as we've been discussing. And what's happening in this country is that we've finally realized, thanks to Japan, that our neglected resource in this country is the enthusiasm and the brains of our worker. And that's what participative management is all about, and that's the message of my book, which is it's not hard, it's not difficult, it's easy to do, and it's pleasant.
There are a lot of companies that are being acquired by larger companies, and this is happening in, I think, nearly every field. And depending on the company, sometimes operations within that company are changed a lot once they're acquired by the larger one. Do you see that happening a lot? That, I mean, are there management problems there where the larger company doesn't really understand what makes a smaller company they've acquired tick?
Oh, certainly. To begin with, you ought to understand why it happens. It's part of the basic problem that boards of directors in this country have two jobs. One is to declare dividends. The other is to kick the chief executive out or retire him and replace him with another chief executive. They've been picking lawyers, accountants, financiers, and Harvard Business School graduates to become chief executives. Now, these people are not comfortable with people. Accountants prefer to deal with numbers. Lawyers prefer to deal with documents. And they do that. Harvard Business School graduates tend to deal with quantifiable facts and reports. That's not what's needed in the country. What's needed is a leader who prefers to deal with people. Now, listen to what happens, or think what happens. You get a Harvard Business School graduate, a lawyer or an accountant, into an office. He gets insecure because he's paid $1 million a year and he knows he's not doing anything constructive for the company. What can he do? A merger, an acquisition, something that will impress his board of directors and his stockholders. That he can do without ever looking an employee in the face. And that's what they do up there. This is one of the reasons we're in the trouble we're in, because U.S. Steel acquires Marathon Oil. Other companies acquire businesses they don't know anything about, can't manage. They can't manage the businesses that they're in, much less the businesses that they acquire. It's a disaster. I mean, when Avis was growing at 35% per annum, our people were having fun. We were all having fun. And I went to Lazard, our owner. At that time, their senior partner was a nice Frenchman named André Meyer. And I said, "Mr. Meyer, I'm burned out here. I've been working here 3 years, and 3 years is long enough for anybody to be chief executive of anything, because it's exhausting to go out and listen to all the problems. You know, we learned in Sunday school that a leader is somebody who washes his people's feet, and I was sick of feet. And I didn't want to hear any more people problems. And so I said, I hereby give you 1 year's notice, because you're a Frenchman and you don't understand things like this. I'm going to retire at the end of a year, or any time between now and the end of a year, and I've got 3 chief executive officers that I can appoint from within, and I'm not going to tell you which I recommend until you tell me I can go." And he said, "If you won't run it, I won't own it." And I said, "Well, if that's the case, it doesn't make much sense. Why don't you list it on the big board and sell it, and sell enough of it every year until you no longer feel you'll own it?" At that point, he said, "Okay," and he actually sent Felix Rowatin over to negotiate with the stock exchange and have him waive the requirements that we didn't yet meet for listing, and Felix did that. But then in came Harold Janine of ITT, and André sold him the company. And I left the day it closed, because Harold Janine and ITT are the kind of people who acquired things and raped them, mismanaged them, stripped them of all their assets and pride and self-respect, and then resold them. It was an atrocity what they were doing in those years. And I left the day, absolutely the day of the closing of Avis. I think mergers and acquisitions are a cop-out of inadequate chief executive officers who don't dare go down on the shop floor for fear some foreman will say, "What the hell are you doing around here allowing these problems to exist and allowing this problem to get worse and worse every year?" They don't dare do that, so they sit in their offices and talk to their lawyers and their consultants and their personnel departments and run a paper factory.
My guest is Robert Townsend, who was the head of Avis for several years in the early 1960s and has written a new book further up the organization that's a sequel to his 1970 book. Let's talk some more about what happens in the kind of management decisions people have to make in smaller companies. And I think this will have a lot of direct impact on our listeners who are both managers and employees. In a lot of places, organization charts are taken really literally, and you do not talk to somebody who is two steps above you. You only talk to that somebody who you report to. How rigid do you think an organization chart should be? How literally need it be taken?
I always used to keep mine on a yellow pad and pencil, and it was sort of a rough schematic of how the organization worked at the moment. But it was constantly changing, and you have to have some kind of a chain of command. But I think there are really two organizations that you should think about in any company. One is the hierarchy, which is used for housekeeping purposes. This is just something that's used for the formal part of getting through the day, and it specifies who's got the right to pick the color of coffee cups and things like that. And then there should be an overlay organization, which is highly unstructured and chaotic and allows anybody to talk to anybody about the business and how to get it done. The only thing is that you have to negotiate in the informal organization, which doesn't have a chart. I mean, just because you have the right to talk to the president doesn't mean that you can buttonhole him every day and bore him out of his skull. You have to be interesting and brief and concise and have useful ideas, and they should be ideas that are appropriate to discuss with him or her. And if you want to go sideways in the organization and talk to somebody else over on the side, you should be able to do that. But you should occasionally think, how am I wearing out my welcome? What am I bringing her or him that's of value and use there? So don't make it a one-way street where you're bleeding people and uncharging their battery, draining their batteries. Work, you have that kind, but you have to give value to get value.
What about job descriptions? How are they best used and best written, do you think?
Oh, come on. I don't even want to talk. Well, let me talk about another good example of participative management, may I?
Sure. What's wrong with job descriptions?
Well, I just, they're the things that have made working for a bad union-dominated company, let's say a steel company, so miserable. Part of it is job descriptions that they've narrowed down to the point where we get the wrench picker-upper syndrome, which we've talked about. I just don't believe in job descriptions. I believe that jobs change and that people should be allowed to change them to fit their own personalities and their own abilities and their own skills. And once you set them in stone in a job description, you strangle your people. Prevent them from growing.
There is in the corporate hierarchy a different level of perks for the people at the top than the people on the bottom. Salaries are higher on top. Sometimes there's better benefits, even special parking spots, special cafeterias if the place is very large. Do you think that's fair? What would you recommend the differences be between the people at the bottom and the top of the power pyramid?
A lot less. But let me answer all of those questions by describing another company that I don't think I've described called Chaparral Steel. 15th largest steel company in the U.S., located in Texas, 8 years old, formed by a participative management guy. A lot of green area around it, trees, on the basis that people spend half their waking lives there. It should be pleasant looking. No reserved parking places for anybody. He said to the officers in the company, he said, this is really for your benefit, because if you have a reserved parking space with your name on it, I'll know when you're goofing off. If your car isn't in it, I'll know when you're playing golf instead of doing something else. Whereas if you don't have one, you could be parked out in the lot somewhere and still wandering around. At any rate, they have profit sharing from the janitor to the president. They have salaries from the janitor to the president, so that if a welder is homesick, he gets paid just as the president would get paid if he were homesick. They have wide halls. When they designed the electric furnace and the rolling mill and the executive office building, the guy who's running it now was in charge of building it. And he sent it back to the architect, and he said, double the width of the halls. And the architect said, are you crazy? That's waste space, doubling the width of the halls. It'll increase the cost and it won't be productive. And he said, not in my company, it's not waste space. You don't think meetings of value take place in offices, do you? He said, how naive can you be? The really important meetings in a company take place in the hallway when a production foreman runs into a maintenance foreman and one says, Joe, something's going wrong on number 3 rolling mill, and I don't know whether it's your fault or my fault, but let's go down there and talk about it, or let's sit down here, or let's stand here in the hall and figure out what it is that's going wrong. Am I doing it bass-ackwards or what? And there are huge halls, and it really works because there are little meetings taking place all over the place. There are boardrooms in the rolling mill. There are boardrooms in the electric furnace, soundproofed, because steel making is a noisy business. Now, these meetings are where the electricians, the welders, the production people, the maintenance people all meet if they got a problem, and they're furnished exactly the same way as the corporate boardroom is in the executive building. Free coffee for everybody, not just the executives. If you're a plant manager, your secretary lives in the plant with you, not in the executive building. The janitor has his office in the executive office building, and the workers, direct labor, have their lockers in the executive building, which tells you without any words what they think of you. And what they do, every year, they take the last generation of workers who've just been hired and have just worked there for a year, and they fly them to any one of a number of neighboring steel plants that are unionized. And they don't say anything. They just fly them on an inspection trip, and they go down there. They land. They get bused to the steel mill, and they go through the plant. Same technology, same plant, same everything. The workers come back and kiss the gateposts of Chaparral Steel, just at the look of how dirty it is, how angry the people are, how what a big gap there is between the executives and the workers. And, you know, they've talked to their counterparts down there. How's your profit-sharing plan set up? We don't have any. Do you have 100% medical and dental benefits like we do? No, we don't have any of that. Or it's 60% contributory, that kind of thing. So that's what's going on today, and that's why I wrote the book, so that if you ever get a chance to do it in your part of the company, you can strike a blow for participative management, because it's got to come. The reason it's got to come is if you're a 10-company industry and 3 companies tumble to it and yours is one of the others, you're either going to start doing it or you're going out of business.
You're opposed to hiring outside consultants. What answer do you give when a company tries to hire you to consult for them?
I've Well, I had that the other day. A woman called me from Tennessee who runs a furniture manufacturing company. They manufacture beautiful furniture, reproductions of antiques that are sold in 300 stores around the country. And she said she started it. She was, her husband died and left her with two sons. And she started making candlestick holders out of discarded textile spindles. And she built that into this furniture company. And she called me and she said, Mr. Townsend, help. She said, I need you to come down and consult. And I said to her, you know, she'd sent me the figures and the stuff like that. And I said to her, you don't need me to consult. Please don't ever call a consultant and call him in. You have taken this company from a gleam in your eye to where it is with your two sons and whoever else. All you're doing is you're in a down period. You're feeling low and down and overworked. And I said, just consult your conscience and do whatever your conscience tells you to do, and it'll be just as good a guide to you as it has in the past. And I hope other people do the same thing in small business.
One more short question. You said at the beginning that one of your goals was to have fun as well as make a profit. Is the amount of fun that you have in a company related at all to the product the company produces? In other words, you were at 20th Century Fox, which makes movies. You were at Avis, which rents cars, and American Express, which is, you know, credit. Does the product of the company affect how much fun you can get out of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's just a question of how everybody needs to be proud of what they do and to consider it important. And the more important it is and the better it is, the better you feel about it and the more fun you have. I probably had the least amount of fun at 20th Century Fox. It is appalling the number of creeps that work in the feature film business. They're just not nice people. And they make an awful product, too. And I'm not just talking about 20th Century Fox. When you think of the fact that they're so bad that 9 out of 10 of their pictures fail to earn the cost back, it gives you an idea how bad they are. And there's so many egomaniacs and so many unreasonable egomaniacs that it's really not a fun business. I had a lot more fun in Avis, which is a terrible, you know, it's not a great business. One of the most fun businesses is a titanium company in the Middle West with Big Jim Daniel running it because he's a great guy and he lives in his golf cart. It's a big company, but he lives in his golf cart and he's always going around and not just saying, hi, how are you, but he's whenever he can find somebody with some time, he'll say, tell me about the business. Are we doing it right or not?
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your approach to management. And my guest has been Robert Townsend, who was the head of Avis and has also been an executive with American Express, 20th Century Fox, and Dun & Bradstreet. He's revised his 1970 bestseller, Up the Organization. The new book is called Further Up the Organization, How to Stop Management from Stifling People and Strangling Productivity. It's published by Knopf. Thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. For folks heading home on the Schuylkill Expressway, things are in pretty good shape westbound. Just a minor delay now around Vine Street, northbound I-95. Some slow going for about a half mile approaching the Ray Street merger. Ray Street itself slowing from 5th Street down to the I-95 on-ramp. And some police activity in Philadelphia at 9th and Lindley. Try to avoid that area. Also, an accident being cleared up in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia on Pratt and Griscom Streets. Also, an accident being cleared up right now in West Hampton Township, Burlington County, on Oxmead Road near Route 541. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battalese.
The Shadow Traffic Report, funded by Wilkie Buick Subaru, tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock. We'll be joined by Robert Creamer, author of the book Stengel, His Life and Times, about Casey Stengel. Leonard Bernstein canceled the National Press Club appearance tomorrow afternoon, so there will be no Press Club broadcast. At 4 o'clock, I'll speak with Pat Goodhart, who is author of the novel The Translator, and then we'll be joined by Maria Cardinal, who is a French-Algerian feminist philosopher.